Go Loud. Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Close Brothers Motor Finance. Recognised on Trustpilot as best in class in Ireland. With fast, fair finance decisions. Made in minutes, sometimes seconds. Motor dealerships and brokers. Looking to become a partner? Get in touch at closemotorfinance.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
We try and bring you all sorts of different guests here on Magnified from all different walks of life, different experiences, different backgrounds. And today we decided to bring you somebody who could be very interesting to you if you're thinking about how you get the best out of your life, particularly in how you get the best nutrition, the best food to make you as fit and healthy as you possibly should be. Because this guest has worked in it on a professional basis for decades now, has worked in high performance sport in particular, working with the likes of the Dublin Gaelic football team when it was winning multiple All-Irelands and with the Leinster rugby team when it was winning European trophies. Daniel Davey is himself a sportsman, and since he's left those environments, he has a new business, self-employed, and he's looking to other sports such as golf, which we'll get to in this interview as well. But he's fascinating in what it is that everybody needs to do to make their own lives better. And I think you're going to very much enjoy the conversation with Daniel as he explains how he got into this and what people need to do for themselves. This series of Magnified, of course, is brought to you by Close Brothers Motor Finance, recognised on Trustpilot as best in class in Ireland, with fast, fair finance decisions made in minutes, sometimes seconds. Motor dealerships and brokers looking to become a partner can reach out to the team at closemotorfinance.ie. I should also have mentioned, when we're talking to Daniel as well, we'll be talking about his experience on Room to Improve, the very popular Dermot Bannon TV series, because himself and his wife had the house made over, and the kitchen in the house for them and for their small children was a very, very important part of that as well. So that's something else that we're going to talk about in this latest edition of Magnified. Daniel Davey, thank you very much for joining us here on Magnified. You're probably a little bit of a different guest in that I am going to be talking to you about your career, but I am also going to be talking to you sort of for advice, sort of start of year advice, which is what you specialise in as a nutritionalist and as an author with the books that you had, Eat Up, Raise Your Game and Eat Up the Next Level, which were extraordinarily successful. And I want to talk to you about GAA and rugby and the teams that you've actually helped. But I suppose the reason I thought of this as a good January podcast was that I've been going to a gym for the last 14 years, personal trainer, Paul Byrne, good friend of mine, and Body Byrne, and has been terrific for me. But he's always said as well that you can't outrun a poor diet. That's one of the most important things that you have to do is make sure that you get your food right. That and your sleep as well, which I know you're big into. But I suppose here's the key thing for you. How difficult is it to get your food right?
It depends. Well, firstly, thank you very much for having me, Matt. I really do appreciate having the conversation. We've had a couple of good ones. It depends on where you're at and your mindset. And you talked about a 15-year journey. I think we begin to engage in our health in different ways at different stages, and fitness is often where it starts first. And we have a relative level of success depending on genetics and often depending as well on our history of exercise. So if we've grown up with a sport, GAA, rugby, whatever it might be, and we've been exposed to it, there's a level of awareness there in how that fitness makes us feel. We don't tend, in general, this is a generalization, we don't tend to draw the same connections when it comes to food, even though it's so obvious, because we have behaviors and we have habits and we have the impact of our environment as we're growing up. And there's a lot depends on that. A lot depends on what level of value is placed on nutrition within the home. So that's a long-winded answer, but it's very different for different people. I'm starting to see a much greater appreciation and awareness now of the impact of understanding one's personal nutrition and drawing that line between performance energy levels, how we feel. But it's very different for each person.
Yeah, because you also have them, but the influencers now. I mean, you're a bit of an influencer yourself on Instagram, but in a positive way. You're sort of grimacing I say that to you. But you're a positive influencer via Instagram, whereas there is this trend now, particularly amongst a lot of younger people, and it's all about taking videos in the gym and showing what sort of workouts and stuff they're doing. But then maybe when it comes to things like their calorific intake, they're into shortcuts rather than putting in necessarily the work that you have to do in the gym.
And I think coming in here, even to have the conversation with you, if this came up, I think that was one of the areas that I probably wanted to stress, and that we are all programmed, no matter what way we like it, in different ways, we're programmed for shortcuts. We're programmed in a way to get to the quickest answers as quickly as fast as possible. And the reality is that when it comes to things like nutrition, it's so heavily influenced by our mood and so many other variables, as I previously mentioned, that going straight to tracking calories or understanding your macronutrients is a very simplistic way of looking at nutrition, because there's so much psychology involved. So you're trying to broaden people's awareness to understand really and truly, the more that you can connect, genuinely connect and create the space for that awareness around what works for your nutrition, the benefits are huge in the long term. And we're starting to connect to that.
Okay, let me make a few analogies here, perhaps. It's a bit like, I think at times, like sort of putting diesel in a petrol engine, the way we eat a lot of food, and particularly the ultra-processed foods, the ready meals, the quick, fast options that we actually take, sort of getting something from Deliveroo or Just Eat, rather than actually making something for ourselves. And then when it comes to it, and you keep telling yourself, well, yeah, you should be better. But then there's an issue of time to actually do the stuff that you need to do in the kitchen, and also confidence that you can actually do it well enough.
Biggest feedback we get from what you just talked about, the actual investment in the skills and education, is confidence, because confidence comes from clarity and confidence comes from being prepared. But again, you mentioned the time part. So what we try to do when we're working with people is to make the best use of our time that we can based on the time available. So it's a very simple good, better, best approach. But what does the week look like? And we have to get ahead in how we approach that week. And if we do that, it creates that sense of confidence and we get better. But if we're going for the pre-prepared meals and things on the go, we're never flexing that skill. We're never creating that very clear pattern in our brain. And it's so interesting you should mention the ready-to-drink meals, powders, even the foods on the shelves, and there's a good, better, best approach to that as well. But that's where the whole thing started for me working in sport. I realized very early on, we're talking about 10 years ago, that that's what people, athletes even, thought that the answer was in. And slowly but surely, it takes time, but you realize the more people have responsibility and accountability around their own food, the greater the potential for better performance.
Well, before we come to what listeners can do for themselves if they're not elite athletes, and I can't imagine too many of the people who are listening to us are going to be elite athletes, I do want to talk to you about what you did with both the Dublin football team and with Leinster Rugby in two of their very highly successful periods. Mm-hmm. And you were, before you did the nutrition for Dublin, for how many years when Jim Gavin?
9 years.
9 years. Mm-hmm. And for Leinster Rugby?
Almost 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay. These players, particularly the rugby players, just take them, they take an enormous calorific intake, don't they? Because they burn off an enormous amount of calories.
They do. They do. And they require different levels of calories depending on their positions, their goals, whether they're a back, whether they're a forward, based on size. But going back to it, these are people that want a simple approach too. And they just want to understand what that looks like in food terms. So it's about that individualized approach, but not overwhelming people with too much detail, but depending on the person.
Yeah, but then you have to do individual tailored programs according to a person's physiology. You know, how much investigation when you're working with a professional athlete do you do into their makeup? And I suppose I'm becoming particularly interested in this as a type 2 diabetic. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in that, but I'm also an asthmatic, and I've recently started on biologic treatment, which has been extraordinary, but that has very much using my blood results to actually get a treatment which is actually designated correct for my body and it's working well. Yeah. And I would presume that given that food is the fuel that you put into the engine, that you have to actually know what sort of engine you have to know what type of fuel to put into it.
It goes in layers. So you start by ensuring that the basic practices around preparation and recovery are being implemented based on the athlete's schedule, based on their injury profile, output of demands, sweat rates. Of course, you get the fundamentals in place first. And as the years go on, players and athletes are always looking for more detail. You're looking for that detail on microbiome, on their overall, what agrees with their digestive system, what benefits their overall immunity. And then you go into new layers like their cardiovascular health and performance, and you start looking at their blood work, their triglycerides, their ratios of HDL to LDL, their omega-3 profile. So it goes on. But what I tried to do was to create a really good awareness over time over where the opportunities were for better performance in the season. So even simple things like a drop off in muscle mass was something that was quite evident as we come into the kind of the business end of the European Cup and the where it really mattered.
Sorry, so why would the muscle mass drop off towards the end of the season?
And that was what we tried to better understand. I think that there's again, even relating back to any person's focus and attention, there's the psychology. So it's a long season and maybe the focus drops a little bit, but also the training load changes because players have to be fresh for the bigger games, which means a drop in maybe strength focus and resistance training. So making sure that athletes' protein intake was exactly where it needed to be, the 2 grams of protein per kg body mass. And those simple reminders as that fatigue maybe comes in a little bit towards the end of the season was critical. So that's just a very, very simple overview. But things are changing constantly. The real specification around vitamins and minerals, we're not there yet. We know about the importance of vitamin D and we would have tested vitamin D, but it is constantly evolving.
But even say for match day, and the reason I bring this up, when I wrote Jamie Heaslip's autobiography with him, he was telling me on match day he could burn 7,000 calories off in a game.
Yeah, now Jamie Heaslip was one of these athletes with one of the highest levels of lean mass. You know, you're talking about someone with muscle mass in the 90s, you know, 92, 93, when he was at his absolute best, plus an athlete who had a very combative position and large distances covered in games. So put all of those together, you're talking about somebody with a very basic need for calories of around maybe 4,000. Then you're putting the match needs and recovery needs on top of it. So it's exceptional. But it's about understanding over the course of days and weeks that if those deficits are there, that's going to impact players' recovery and energy levels. So that's a very specific one, but it's drawing that out over the course of days and weeks. And that's what I was talking about in relation to the drop in, let's say, muscle mass in those critical periods.
How do you measure all of this?
That's one of the areas that I specialized in, was analyzing players' body composition throughout the course of the season. So levels of lean mass were measured about 4 times across the year. It's actually something that I've mentioned before, that we all should have an understanding of what our muscle mass is if we can. People get very fixated on body fat, but if you're investing in your muscle mass, we know that the strongest members of the population have some of the lowest levels of mortality. We know that the higher levels of muscle mass you have, the greater insulin sensitivity, so you process glucose better. Higher levels of muscle mass, lower injury, better all function throughout the course of her life.
And very important for aging, again, go back to my friend Paul Byrne, has been emphasizing that it's really important when you certainly get to my age, and I'm in my late 50s now, that you actually have to emphasize the weight-bearing resistance training rather than necessarily the aerobic training.
Exactly. So it's trying to get those combinations right. And we are seeing right across the board at all ages, people beginning to pay attention to that. My mother, for the first time, 60, actually, let's leave her age out of it. But she's in her 60s and she's taken up resistance training. And she's asking now, even though I've talked about it for 20 years, she's asking now why she didn't connect on this beforehand. And it's a conflict.
It also helps with the brain, doesn't it?
It does.
Because it gives you release of positive hormones and things and chemicals.
And it helps with even circulation and driving of blood and, again, this recovery process that happens within the brain. So there's all sorts of links to overall mental health and brain health.
But then if you are doing that muscle-bearing exercise, it's important, isn't it, that you eat appropriately to that?
And this is the critical component because... But you started, you opened by saying you can't outrun or...
Yeah, you can't outrun a bad diet.
You can't outrun a bad diet. So if you're not eating well, if there's not a very simple structure in place for that recovery, adequate nutrients, adequate energy and the spread of those key nutrients, then it doesn't matter how well you train. That is just one component.
When you're working with professional athletes like Leinster Rugby, how attuned are they to all of this? Because, and then how does it also go with, you know, in rugby it's known the lads like their few pints when they've won a game or whatever.
It goes back to the spectrum that you see. You mentioned Jamie Heaslip. I actually did a video a couple of months back because I was reading back over some of the things that he did and he was genuinely ahead of his time. The level of detail and depth that Jamie went into would probably still be ahead of where a lot of athletes are. That's how intentional he was about his body and his mind, and full credit to him. So he was an early adopter in a lot of these things. But you've got people at the other end who want to play the sport and just want to enjoy it. And I can think of so many people, I'm not mentioning any names, but people who just do what they need to do because they're a professional athlete. So you're going to get a different level of buy-in and attention, but people would be amazed at some of the behaviours that you see from professional sports people. You mentioned alcohol. It has absolutely changed, but people still enjoy their pints and their pizza and their treats, and there has to be space for that.
Occasionally.
Occasionally. And Jim Gavin, and I reference this quote all the time, he'd be on the bus after a big game and he would say, look, we don't have any rules around alcohol here. You just ask yourself the question, will this impact my performance?
Is he guilting them in that stage?
Well, it's a question. Everything was based around that. You can have your drinks, no problem. How much? Well, you know the answer to that. And it was genuinely a way of empowering people to make the right choices.
Treating them like adults.
And treating them like adults. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant. So there was never any really strict rules about it, but people know their bodies better than ever now.
And tell us about working with the Dublin football team. Now, you actually were a good footballer yourself, but you might have been perhaps your career maybe handicapped by the fact that you were born in Sligo, was it?
I'm not going to make any excuses for that. I think...
come on, you're an All-Ireland senior football club winner.
I am. I am. I suppose...
Like Alan Kearns, who we had on with us in last week's programme. Yes.
Absolutely. And Alan was an incredible sports person. I suppose when you start to really understand the top level of sport, it's very good at placing you in your in where you are as a sports person. But as actually, I probably... It has taken a little bit of time, but I have more appreciation for my involvement in playing senior football, both in Sligo, but with Ballyboden over that period. So I think talking about business, I use the Dublin football team and the experience of working there, I suppose, on a connection level, on the person level, and then the standards and the processes from professional sport. It's that overlap between those both environments have had a massive impact.
I'm very interested in sort of the Dublin footballers is an amateur setup, but
yes,
it's professionally run.
Yes.
So there are different demands on the players because we've spoken about diet and exercise, but rest and sleep is very important as well. And a lot of these footballers are now, the demands are quite extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Early morning training sessions, full day in work afterwards, maybe more training in the evening or whatever. Very, very long days where they don't get the opportunity to rest the body or perhaps to manage their food intake in a way that a professional athlete would.
I'll add to that that it was the rest of the mind that I began to understand an awful lot more as the years went on. And you know, even someone like Jack McCaffrey has openly talked about what that feels like. And the bottom line as a sports person, whether you're an amateur elite or you're a professional sports person, it never leaves your mind, because it's not just about how you live and those behaviors and the consequences of one bad night's sleep on your performance, but it's the fact that you're totally consumed by it. And it's about trying to create that space for intentional recovery, which is really challenging. I think the overall feeling is, though, that there's an enjoyment and a fun, a part of being in this that's awful important to protect. And I think now we're in an area where that has very obviously become more challenging.
How'd you get into all of this?
I suppose I'll go back to being a child. And just beforehand, we were talking about just the impact of your environment. I was sports insane. I was a kid who would have kicked a ball against a wall for 4 hours a day. I was that kid, and I was just completely and utterly intrigued and had an insatiable curiosity about what impacted the body. I wanted to be a professional sports person or a vet. And
bit different career paths.
Big time. I'm from a small farm, and some of the best things that happened on the farm, well, I don't mean, maybe not all, but when the vets came, it was like an education of what we were doing, whether it
What's
be...
What sort of farming were you doing?
Cattle and sheep later. I still have a small sheep farm at home. Eileen, my mum, is managing that now. But it was that experience from the farm that influenced me. My grandparents had a huge impact on the value around food from a farming background. Just being exposed to what really good felt like and tasted like was a big thing. And then it was all about this part I can't really figure out, but I connected strength and food really early. So you eat well and you do hard work and you get strong. And that was something that I really valued and always had an awareness of. I was terrible in school. I was terrible from a maturity perspective. I wasn't academic. I used whatever opportunities I possibly could to avoid school. And then when I got into college, I started to better understand the science. And I couldn't believe that these connections between how we ate and how we lived, that there weren't more clear and obvious careers in them. So put that together with maybe some friends that worked in the space, being a sports person. If I wasn't going to play at the very highest level myself, I genuinely had a vision of working with top sports people in this country.
When did it become clear to you that you weren't going to get to the level you wanted in sport and you would have to go for maybe a more conventional career?
I've taken my first deep breath, because it is actually a big, something that really hurt was I didn't get the opportunities, or maybe I didn't deliver on the opportunities when I was with Sligo during those periods. And it's kind of funny, even me talking about, it's the only thing I feel a little bit of imposter syndrome around because of how badly I wanted to represent my county and perform at the best I could. I always had, that was a big part of what I wanted to achieve. So I didn't hit that level. I didn't take those opportunities. And I started to realize I needed to put my focus into my career and playing club football for sure.
Did you make the inter-county squad?
I did on a couple of occasions. And I did for 2 years. I actually played with London for a year, and that was an amazing experience. And I came back from London after doing my master's, spent 2 years on the county panels, in and out of the team, but mostly on the bench. And we all know, if you don't make it at inter-county level very early on, it's unusual then to establish yourself. There's not that many Brian Fentons going around. So I started to accept that part and put my attention into my career. And then that focus went to, if I get a chance with Jim Gavin or at the time a Joe Schmidt or with Guy Easterby, I'm going to take it.
And then how did you feel when you went into the Dublin setup? I mean, you talk about imposter syndrome. Okay, you're doing a job and you have a specific job, but was there not a little bit of a feeling is that these guys are better footballers than I used to be? How can I tell them what to do? You're sort of laughing at me now and you're just smiling as you're answering.
I actually haven't been asked that question before and I wasn't anticipating the conversation to go this direction. I think I had enough belief in what strategies worked for performance nutrition because I had done so much work in that area that I was really up to speed. I had huge conviction in its potential to influence performance. And I begin to show that with them that these are areas within, as we've talked about, body composition, but on-field energy. And I started to break down these strategies into very simple practices. So I had huge core belief in those behaviors and what it would take to make that difference. It is actually an awful lot easier because I was a Gaelic footballer in Dublin than it was in Leinster. That was a completely different ball game.
Was the fact that you played club level, you had won an All-Ireland club football title, so there was a degree of respect. He's one of ours almost.
Exactly. And it's funny, even since I've left being there, some of those athletes would have even said, you are one of us. I wasn't from a rugby background. I didn't understand the game. I didn't understand professional sport. And I didn't fully realise this first phase of, I don't want to call it initiation, but are you up to it? That really does exist in professional sport. Like, are you able to deal with the pressure of expectation?
And I suppose if you went in during the Joe Schmidt era, when he was starting to enforce these professional standards upon Leinster, notoriously demanding by reputation of his players, I presume the same applies to people like you.
And you're warned about that. You're warned about, you're given very clear insight to types of expectation. I remember even writing an article that was going to be in response to maybe something that Paul Kimmage put out about creatine or something I had to, and I remember submitting that and I put a lot of work into it. And the amount of red writing that came back and the amount of changes. From Joe. And that was required. It's good, but. And it was some insight for me as a performance nutritionist coming from, at that stage, I was coming out of reading all that research and writing a lot of this type of work, but he still had a lot of edits for me.
And what was it like then on the days of big games? When you're there, I mean, do you feel part of almost as invested as you would have been when you were a squad member in Sligo when you were playing club football with Ballybolton?
No.
No?
No. No.
Because Roy Keane's been given out recently about the masseurs giving in the photographs of the players as if they were, sort of responsible for the victories.
And I really understand that because are you there for yourself or are you there to make a difference to those athletes? And I was genuinely and always have been there for that athlete or for that team. And then you do begin to develop a trust and a relationship whereby you've gone through that first year, because it's a year before people go, what's the value? Are they able to evolve? Are you able to give the kind of information that's going to make a difference to me personally? So that changes a little bit over time and you do feel like now on a level you're contributing, but the pressure, genuine pressure to maintain a standard and to be seen to continue to evolve your impact and your role is so significant that it is such a short feeling that you have during those games. Like your day to day is what matters. And then those experiences they're incredible. They are absolutely incredible, but it switches so quickly to, okay, what needs to be done on Monday morning?
Okay. But I presume you enjoyed Dublin winning in Croke Park, Leinster winning Heineken Cups when you were involved with the squad.
I can't emphasize enough, they are absolutely pinch me outer body incredible experiences. They are the closest thing that I've ever come to a drug. It is. That is it. And when it's what you always wanted to do, it, and then you're there, you do ask yourself, am I actually working with these athletes? Am I here? Is this happening? You can't stay in those moments for too long, but yeah, it is incredible.
So you did it for how many years with both of them?
Yeah, it's funny how even you asking that question about the emotion brings me to how it feels and the pain, because it is like a type of a breakup when you move on. There's a very clear thing in your mind all the time about how long this is going to last. And there's a desire to continue to show your impact and be a part of something, because you want to show that evolution. You want to show that you are there and that you're committed. But then from being in those environments, the way players move on every season, backroom team move on, you know that it's going to be your time at some point.
You probably lasted a lot longer than many players and coaches.
Yeah, I did. And
certainly
at
Leinster anyway.
Yeah.
There's a remarkable degree of consistency in Dublin.
For sure. I think when Stuart Lancaster came in and he started talking about the performance clock and how everybody, particularly even when it comes to coaches, have this first 2 years where you're embedding, you're on the upward trend, and then year three maybe begin to plateau, and then you have to work really hard over the next 2 years to maintain that relationship and that attention. I'm there for 9 years. I very clearly became conscious of, is my voice starting to wane in terms of its impact? Have they just got used to seeing what I do? And I think that there's an inevitability of that happening within those environments. People like to hear new voices and hear of new ideas.
As you left both Dublin and Leinster around the same time, didn't you?
Yeah, within a year or so of each other. Yeah. And I just, there's an instinct where you go, what do I want to do? And I am incredibly ambitious, and I always knew I wanted to do other things. I didn't know what it was going to be, but I have a better idea now, but it's taken a long time to figure that out.
And what is it now?
I want to continue to show people what it means to properly invest in their health. And you mentioned as well, even the listeners mightn't be at an elite level from a sports perspective, but it is extraordinary how many people out there are living in a way that replicates a performance person's schedule, and they're not investing in the ways that they should. And that's what I'm trying to draw a greater awareness of, that it is a lot about how you see yourself and your personal identity. And when you begin to identify as a high performer, really start to think about, what are the things that allow me to perform really well at work? And even within my hobby, there's this knock-on effect in other areas. But I would like to say that working with sports people continues to be the thing that really excites me. And golf at the highest level is something I'm really keen. I'm very interested personally. I play golf. And I see a big opportunity in that area.
So why golf? I mean, I suppose actually I'm thinking of it now. There used to be the perception of golfers, guys who were maybe were a bit overweight and liked their pints at the 19th hole. I'm not talking about the amateurs. I'm talking about the professional golfers as well. But it's quite clear that in the last decade or so in particular, an awful lot of the top golfers are very fit athletes. Rory McIlroy, for example, looks like a guy who does serious work in the gym. Mm-hmm. Now, there may be a requirement to get the psychologist to actually help him to win the first major since 2014. It's that long ago at this stage. And there's a mental thing in sport as well, which probably just goes against the food and all the rest of the stuff. But why do you think to golfers, and where are you going to get into in that?
I started playing golf, actually, it was my wife that introduced me to golf. I started playing golf towards the end of my football career, so it's not that long. It's probably better that I didn't, because of how much I enjoyed it and how much I enjoyed the actual game. And I started to actually look at the physical demands, just even as an amateur golfer, and they're huge. And then I started to realize that there's a lot of elite golfers are playing as much as 36 holes, playing golf for 8 hours a day. Then you look at the behaviors and I mean, they are shocking. I was working with an elite golfer playing at amateur national level here in Ireland last year, who wasn't even hydrating properly. So when you think about the tiniest margins that there are in golf, the tiniest margins, I remember talking to a professional athlete, one of the top pros, doesn't matter about who it was, but a very well-known Irish golfer. He talked to me about this one shot. If you could help me save this one shot. And I was like, one shot? Are you absolutely kidding me? When you think about the connection between how we eat, how we drink, and the amount of science that is very clearly there about the influence of that on performance. One shot could be, maybe not a round, but you might see one or two shots across a tournament. Like that one.
All the difference.
All the difference. And now I'm seeing all of these behaviors and this real lack of awareness, except at the top. And you can clearly see Tiger started it from the strength conditioning. You see him, he's chewing gum, probably a caffeine gum. You can see that they've all got their electrolyte drinks, but that still really feels at the top level.
I'm just going to do a little sidebar on this. I remember being at the Ryder Cup in 2006, and this was before I ever started playing golf. I only started playing in 2020 and have become a little bit obsessed with it. But being at the Ryder Cup, Darren Clark, after hitting his tee shots, was chomping on a big cigar. I remember thinking, like, what? And I mean, famously, he sort of started quaffing pints, throwing back pints after they'd won. Fair enough, they'd won. But I couldn't believe that an athlete was out on the course and there he is sucking on a big cigar after taking his tee shot.
Yeah. It's absolutely insane. And with the alcohol, the Snickers bar, the Mars bar, the Lucozade energy, all of these things are what we know as the culture in golf. And if you look at the top, you look at somebody like Rory McIlroy, whatever about the number of majors he's won in the last 10 years, look at his consistency, look at the way that he lives in his life. And that's the point when it comes to golf. You can have one-off incredible levels of performance, but doing it back-to-back, week-to-week, that's where the demands are. I actually have a really exciting opportunity potentially later this year in the States that it hasn't been all confirmed yet, but that's the type of direction I want to go.
Because you effectively decided about 5 years ago, was it, that you needed to set up as a business independently from being an employee of these sports organizations?
Exactly. Exactly. And the truth of it is, I thought it was going to be an awful lot easier than it was. It has been the most outrageous grind. I'm working and I'm as much and as demanding as working in professional sports was, I'm still working as hard, but in a very different way. Now I've got a young family and they obviously take my full attention and they're my priority, but it's been way more. I thought it was going to be easier because of my connections to those environments, but it certainly didn't just happen.
Is this because I've been self-employed?
Yeah. Yes. And
having to go and find work. And then when you found the work, fulfill the work.
And then there's this really hard part of, so a value of mine is about impact. I don't want to just work with people and deliver workshops. I'm constantly thinking, how is this going to impact a team, athlete, organization over the months and year ahead? But nutrition and performance is like any other skill that has to be developed. You don't just do a talk or have a consultation and, oh, well, you have the information now. Because it's not about information. It's about behavior. And we recognize that within fitness, but we don't.
So I think maybe that's why your two books were so successful. I mean, the food books or cookbooks do gangbusters every year when it comes to Christmas presents, and all the publishers have a whole range of books. But I think yours was a little bit different. There were sort of food instructions for looking after, making your own breakfast, your own mueslis and stuff. But I think it was more about trying to actually get people to think about how they actually approached going about a very important part of their day.
Exactly. And if you are getting people to think about that at the most basic level, rather than being reactive to situations. Now we're starting to make a little bit of progress. And the simplest thing that you can do is look at your day and look at your days ahead. And this is going back to working in sports. This is what we do. We create a periodized, very simple periodized plan. Different training and different training demands on different days. Simply align your nutrition to that. So a day where you train in the gym, we're, depending on your goal, we need more calories because we're expending more calories. It's a very, very basic premise, but we don't actually think about it like that. We just very often do the same thing or don't have any plan at all.
Yeah, I wonder how many people really put plans in. I suppose I'm going to personalize this to an extent in that I sometimes feel, you know, I come home after doing the last word. I get home around 7:30 and I'm feeling too tired to make the effort to make myself something. Mm-hmm. And I always say to Aileen, look, I'm not expecting you to have something. Mm-hmm. You know, you're busy yourself. You have your own work. Yeah. You know, I'm not expecting somebody else to make my food for me, which I suppose is an awful lot of Irish males probably do expect somebody else to make their food for them. Although hopefully that's changing. Is it with a lot of younger people or is it?
I would say that it is beginning to change because I think men are taking a little bit more responsibility. I think it depends a lot on what happens in a home. I talk a lot about education as well. If you, you know, you go back to something like the subject of home economics and what an incredible subject that was for me. It was the only subject that I really, well, ag science and home economics were the two that I enjoyed. There was only two boys in any of the home economics. And that was me and another guy called Don. And I think that that's, you know, there's an encouragement from the home around at a very early age that's very important. But back to your question, it's about responsibility. And we still have a culture that maybe our nutrition isn't our responsibility, it's somebody else's. And that's the first step for a lot of men. Is to take.
Mammy makes the lunch and the dinner and the breakfast for them and all the rest of it.
Yeah. And then who does it become? Your wife or your partner. That's what they do. And I know from working with a lot of people that has changed, but there's still an awful lot of work to do.
Because I noticed from your Instagram feed, and you're very popular, I think you've about 150,000 followers on Instagram, and you do these little videos. And I was looking at them and a couple of things struck me. One, and I just take a simple example of one you put up recently, just showing people how to properly cut up an onion. Right? Mm-hmm. Which actually, when I was thinking about it, that's obvious. And then actually it's not obvious. Mm-hmm. To a lot of people, it actually isn't obvious. Mm-hmm. That was one thing that you often sometimes need to show to give people confidence, mm-hmm. show them how to do the seemingly obvious things. But the second thing was that you're involving your small children off camera, mm-hmm. but you can hear the voices. You're teaching them and you're teaching them to take responsibility for their own food intake.
I am. And what I would like to say is there's two parts to that. The first thing is that I didn't know how to chop an onion. And even as someone who studied, who I did home economics, and then I go on and I do nutrition degrees, and I was never taught at any, really, at those stages. I certainly didn't learn. But it was when we started to do food demos in Leinster, in particular, that it was demonstrated to me. And I realized the value of being able to do these little skills, like even as simple as having a really good peeler versus the type of peelers that people use, besides cutting the top of your finger off. It makes life easier. If you can do things well, even in terms of where things go, all of that has a big impact on our behavior and how we feel about approaching it when we come home tired at 7:30 in the evening. Do we have a 10-minute meal that we can make? That's the first part. That's the first part of it. The second part is that I never thought I would be as relaxed with my children around food as I was. It took me a long time to be so comfortable with the overall approach to nutrition, and maybe the assumption that a nutritionist is going to have children with these perfect behaviors. I don't, and I won't, and I'm way more accepting of the sweets and all of those things, because what you realize as you get a little bit older, of course, is that you adopt the values of your home, and people have to find their own way in that. But get a really good start on all these things, involve them in the process, you've got a far better chance.
I wonder how much people have come back to the issue of shortcuts. And again, sort of personalizing this, but I'm on Ozempic because of my diabetes. Mm-hmm. And I have found it incredibly helpful mm-hmm. in helping me to combat weight gain. That I lost about 12 kilos after I went on it. And I'm on it now nearly 5 years, and I've kept the weight off at this stage. But I wonder, particularly in the future, how many people are just going to sort of depend on new medications, improving medications, to do the work for them rather than being disciplined themselves in what they should be doing.
I was at a conference last year in Sligo, and there was a brilliant researcher and presenter on pharmaceuticals or medication for the treatment of certain things, like whether it be obesity, type 2 diabetes. And it had a big impact on my attitude. And I realized through some of the research that was presented, in that there are many cases where medication is now required. And I wasn't as aware about how important you are at a certain stage of maybe overweight or where your physiology is.
Yeah, it's your genetics sometimes.
It's your genetics. And I think we still have even within the health industry, a very judgmental outlook or attitude towards it. But I absolutely do believe, again, going back to it, and I actually have this reference that I use all the time now in this past year about this shortcut idea. And I know we touched on it for a split second beforehand. I didn't know it was going to come up, but I think it's a good analogy. And that is, when we were doing Room to Improve, I knew of Dermot Bannon, and I knew that he had a huge amount of experience, and there's obviously the end product in what you see. The end product and the results are this, wow, oh my God. And I thought, particularly around the area of my kitchen, that like the design of the house, you're going to be presented with these options and you just pick them. And Dermot repeatedly said over the overall experience and the journey of creating the home, that the kitchen was so important that I had to be really clear about what I wanted. And I needed to be clear about what it looked and felt like. And I spent, this is not an exaggeration, hundreds of hours, maybe 1,000 hours, scrolling, looking at other kitchens, looking at all of these other ways to do things, constantly avoiding the real question about what I wanted. So it was like there was this switch where he asked me a question about something about home. And I talked to him about, my dad passed away a couple of years ago. And I talked to him about something my mother did as part of his memory. She built a fireplace out of stone from around the area. And the idea was we would light it in part of his memory. It was a very simple way to stay connected to that, you know, to his memory. I shared the story. And so he started to say, so things like home and stone are important. He said, I want you to elaborate on how that made you feel. So anyway, the reason I share that is that it is exactly the same. People come very often with this idea that somebody else will solve their problems. I will give a meal plan. I don't give out meal plans. Dermot Bannon doesn't give you the perfect option. You have to figure out what way that you're going to live yourself. And that's hard. That's not easy. And most people constantly go through their lives thinking that it is a training plan that's going to be handed to you, or a nutrition plan that you follow, and that that's where the solutions are.
Just thinking in relation to your kitchen, did your wife have an input, or was it all down to you?
It's funny. Like, there was obviously a lot of controversy about that. Does she have any input in this? But of course she did. Of course she absolutely did. And we both love the kitchen.
How was the process? I actually didn't see the episode of the programme. I'd read about it, that you had a conservatory which was leaking heat effectively, and that was the main thing that had to be looked after. But you also had a budget that you actually had to follow.
Yeah.
What's the experience like of doing that when you, I'm sure lots of people have done renovations in homes, but doing it when you have cameras coming in and out and you have to perform with Dermot Bannon to make a TV show out of it?
Well, I'm not just saying this. I think a big part of the success of our experience, because it was an incredible success, was Dermot and his ability to we developed a very good connection with Dermot and his ability to help us see what was really important. And it created this whole new awareness for me about the impact of your environment and space at home. I am an incredibly practical and functional thinker. The cold bothered my wife and my kids way more than it bothered me. And the roof was leaking and I just thought, I need to sort this kitchen out. But Dermot has this ability to create this far better awareness about lighting and flow. And it is honestly night and day. Like the investment in our home around, of course, it being more comfortable, but how we actually live and how we eat together and all of the things that he drew out of listening to us around what was really important has made an incredible impact on us and how we live.
I get the impression from the conversation that we've had that it's very important for you in your work and probably beyond that as well, developing relationships, isn't it? You actually have to be able to get on with people. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to do your work properly.
I would even go as far as to say that every single positive business relationship, professional sporting relationship has been based on that connection. And I realized that has helped also. Being very clear on that chemistry, being right with people has prevented me making some big business mistakes too.
So just to summarize this, to sort of finish up in relation to this, and I think I sort of, even as I get on, I'm looking at various things. So I just have to make sure that I get the best out of the rest of my life that's available to me and the rest of it. I want to be healthy and I want to be fit and I want to be active and do things. It's never too late to try and build good habits, is there? Is it? I mean, like, it'd be very easy to just say, look, this is the way I've always done it. You know, old dogs don't change, the rest of it. You can actually pick up new habits if you want to, can't you?
You absolutely can. And there's one thing that is becoming incredibly evident, and this is only recent. And it is this true, like not this kind of tick box attitude towards disconnection from our work and from media and social media and consumption of technology. We ran an event in Sligo back in October where there was no access, up in the Ox Mountains, there was no access to any media. And we did a full program of everything we've talked about over the last while. And some of the most important feedback, this wasn't even intended, but some of the most important feedback was that their phone was left in their car. And that actually was the biggest thing that allowed them to really think about what was important to them and their health. And I think it's going to be even harder and harder for people to invest, like you said, and make those changes unless that happens.
Daniel Deevy, it's been great having you on Magnified. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
So our thanks again to Daniel Deevy for taking the time. You actually can find his work on Instagram. And of course, there's also the books that he has written as well, which were really, really popular. And again, our thanks to our series partner, Close Brothers Motor Finance, rated excellent on Trustpilot for customer service. The portal Close Connect means that it can say yes more often, approve finance applications in minutes and sometimes seconds. So if you're looking to partner with Close Brothers Motor Finance, reach out to the motor finance people at Close Motor Finance. So that's it for today. Hope you can come back to us. We have more great guests in this Magnified series in the coming weeks. From me, Matt Cooper, thank you for being with us.
Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Close Brothers Motor Finance. With Close Connect, our technology means we can say yes more often. Approve finance applications in minutes and sometimes seconds. Partner with Close Brothers Motor Finance at closemotorfinance.ie.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.